Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hello and welcome to The Upgrade, a podcast from the team at lifehacker.com, where we help you improve your life one week at a time. I'm Melissa Kirsch, editor-in-chief of Lifehacker.
And I'm Andy Orn, an editor with Lifehacker.
And this week we're talking to financial whiz Felix Salmon.
I have so much money because I'm a whiz.
Felix is a senior editor at Fusion, which is sort of a sister or cousin site to Lifehacker. He used to be a finance blogger for Reuters, and he's also the co-host of Slate's Money podcast. And most importantly, he is in possession of a plummy English accent that makes him sound very smart. So he's the perfect person to be imparting financial advice or to play the villain in a Disney movie.
It's true. You can listen to me and say, oh, I must don't trust that guy. He's got that accent which makes me want to believe him, and you should believe me because I'm actually quite nice. I'm the villain with a heart of gold. Would I lie to you?
I don't know. Let's find out.
It depends.
All right, so Felix is here to talk to us about how to be less stupid about money.
Don't be stupid about money.
But a lot of people, they don't want to invest their time. They don't want to look at the details of their paycheck and their credit cards and all that. They just want to, you know, sit down at the end of the day and figure out how to survive, right?
You can either think too little about money or you can think too much about money. And most people are kind of doing both at the same time. They don't think enough about the basic sensible things that you can do to just be sensible about life. And then instead what they do is they lie awake at night worrying about debt collectors. And that's just the worst combination. The trick is to just make a couple of relatively simple decisions, set yourself up, and then don't think about it. Set it and forget it.
Given that, let's talk about banking, which is something that everybody loves to think about.
Does anyone like their bank?
No, nobody. Like, who even has a bank anymore?
I mean,
like,
I'm completely ambivalent. I'm with Chase. I don't care. I don't know any better or any
worse.
There
was a time when, like, you chose your bank based on how many branches there were near where you lived or worked. Like, you were looking for ATM branches.
And this is one of the reasons why banks opened so many branches in recent years, is because they know that that's how people choose their bank. They just want the one which is most convenient, the fewest number of footsteps from their doorstep, which is kind of a stupid way of picking your bank, to be honest.
Do you even need a bank now?
You don't. And this is actually one of the wonderfully freeing things. If you hate your bank, if you are constantly being hit with overdraft fees or various other fees and interest, and you just find yourself on the phone with them, screaming at them and frustrated at them and saying, no, give me a refund. And you just want to strangle them. And this is a very common feeling with many banks. You don't need to stay in that abusive relationship. You can leave, and you can leave the entire banking world. You can get something which is gives you everything you need and isn't a bank account.
Are you talking about putting a pile of money under your mattress or what?
No. I am talking about this wonderful thing which exists called reloadable prepaid debit cards. So we've all had debit cards. You know, we've had gift cards from Home Depot or whatever it is.
Or a debit card from a bank.
Oh, debit cards for a bank are basically just ways to take money out of your bank account.
Mm-hmm.
The prepaid debit cards where you get a gift card, say, and you can spend, sometimes they just have a Visa or MasterCard or American Express logo on them, and you can spend them in any store, and they have a certain amount of money on them, and then once you've spent down that money, you've spent the money. But you often get them during the holidays as presents, you know. They're quite popular because everyone who doesn't, they're the equivalent to cash without being quite as umsky as cash, to use a technical word.
Mm.
What they have now is reloadable prepaid debit cards, so you can just go on the internet. If you have a job and your job pays you, they can pay you via direct debit onto your debit card rather than into your bank account. So you can have a constant stream of money from your employer onto your debit card. There's always money on your debit card. And then you just use your debit card to pay for things.
But there's a bank there. Where is the money going? Like, it's not going to my debit card, right? Like, there's, like, some institution that's taking my money still.
There is an institution, and there are various different ways in which it's technically structured, which I'm not going to bore you with because it's boring and you don't need to worry about it. But, and yes, you're right, invariably there is some bank you've never heard of, but don't worry about that. The point is that it's incredibly simple. With a debit card, if you don't have enough money on your debit card, it just won't work. You try and buy a $50 thing when you only have $20 on the credit card and it won't go through and you can't buy it. Okay, fine. I don't have that money. I can't spend it. It's incredibly simple and often it's free. So if you take a couple of the most popular ones, like Bluebird from American Express is a great one. It's totally free. Chase has one called Liquid. They have this thing called Chase Liquid, which is not a bank account. And it doesn't have the fees that a bank account has. So, Andy, I don't know if Chase is charging you a certain monthly fee if you drop below a certain average balance, or if they might start charging you overdraft fees if you, go overdrawn or something like that.
Right.
None of that will happen with the debit card. It's effectively equivalent to a really bare bones bank account, and you are never going to get angry at them and scream at them because there's really nothing that can go wrong.
What about, like, so my checking account, I get interest on my checking account, not a ton of interest, but I do get interest on the money that I have in my checking account. Like, wouldn't I be forfeiting that? And related, wouldn't it be better to be using a credit card and getting points or something for every dollar that I spend rather than just using a debit card for everything I buy?
In terms of interest, two things. One, there are debit cards which do pay interest. BBVA has one. But ultimately, the interest you get on your checking account is so tiny that you shouldn't make financial decisions based on getting interest on your checking account. You know, one overdraft fee is going to wipe out 8 years worth of interest. So don't even... Like, don't let your choice of bank or your choice of whether or not to bank be determined by a 0.1% interest rate. That's just silly. In terms of credit cards, yes, you can get points. It's free stuff. And who doesn't like free stuff? The problem with credit cards is you are borrowing money. Every single time you make a purchase, you are borrowing money. And what the genius of the financial services industry is that they've conflated two different things. One is the payment mechanism and one is the borrowing mechanism, and they've made it the same thing. So every time you use your credit card, you are both paying for something and borrowing money simultaneously. And while it's convenient to pay for something with a credit card, and they bribe you to pay for something with a credit card by giving you the miles or whatever it is that you're generating on your credit card, you are also going into debt at the same time. So if you are one of those wonderfully disciplined people who always pays off your credit card in full at the end of the month and never carries any kind of a balance, then it's free money and go ahead and do it. And it's awesome. And that's what I do. And so I would totally say go find yourself a cheap credit card, which gives you lots of perks, and knock yourself out. If, on the other hand, you're the kind of person who wakes up one morning with five different credit cards and they all have balances on them, you're thinking to yourself, eek, I'm $8,000 in debt and I don't know how I'm ever going to be able to pay this off. And some of these credit cards have 25% interest rates. Yeah, you're not helping yourself by doing that.
Before we get too far in the weeds with the credit cards, I'm still curious about these reloadable debit cards. Like, it's true that I would get charged fees if I did overdraft my checking account or something, but it doesn't usually happen. So what's the main advantage of these cards?
So if you are, again, a disciplined person who keeps whatever the minimum balances are in your checking account and generally has a good relationship with your bank, then keep that good relationship with your bank. I would never recommend someone who's happy with their bank to switch to a reloadable debit card.
If you like your bank, you can keep your bank.
Exactly. If you don't like your bank, but you like the idea of having a bank, that's also great. If you like to be able to deposit cash into your bank account, it's basically impossible to do that with a reloadable debit card.
Or if you get a paper check rather than direct deposit.
Paper checks can
job.
Be done, but it takes a little bit of time. You generally need to do it by mail and that kind of stuff. So if you're a freelancer and you're and people sometimes pay you in like $100 bills and you don't want to just keep them in your wallet and you want to put them in your bank account, it's a good idea to have a bank account. Reloadable debit cards are basically for a very, very basic, simple thing. And if you want to go up a notch, there's a wonderful product called Simple. It's a bank slash debit card. It kind of behaves a bit like a reloadable debit card in that everything is done through their card that they give you, which is a debit card, but it is attached to a bank account and it does a bunch of things that bank accounts can do as well. It is completely free. It's a bit like the Bluebird card from American Express in that it doesn't charge you any monthly fees, it doesn't charge you any overdraft fees, nothing like that, and it's very friendly and there's a wonderful app which works very well. So that's a great sort of in-between solution there. But if you want a complete full-service bank with human tellers who you can talk to, who will try to upsell you on various, you know, financial products and insurance and stuff, go to your local credit union. They're often really friendly and generally are much more likely to keep your money in the community and help the community. But yeah, if you're at a huge, big bank like Chase or Citi or Bank of America and you don't have a problem with them, then stay where you are because switching is a pain in the ass.
This is kind of a dumb question, but how do credit unions work? Like, if this isn't a big corporation, who are these people?
The credit union is us. So I'm a member of the Lower East Side People's Federal Credit Union, and I have an account there, and a lot of other people on the Lower East Side of New York have accounts there. And the money that we have in our accounts is lent out to the borrowers. And when the borrowers pay interest, you know, that keeps the credit union going, and it's all within the community, and it's owned by the people who have the bank accounts. There's no sort of corporate entity in some foreign country who owns it. There's no shares listed on the stock exchange, which can be speculated on. It's just keeping money in the community, and it's a good thing.
But you still have like an ATM card and checks and
Absolutely.
All of these things, just like with a bank.
Yes.
Okay. That's interesting. I mean, because people always say that you should like support your local credit union. I'm like, if it's owned by the people, it's a cooperative system, then like who's actually doing the work of running it?
There are employees.
Okay.
And they get paid. I mean, the board members like myself don't get paid, but the employees get paid. So there'll be a CEO, but the CEO, you know, my bank earns like a five-figure salary. Right, these are not like this bank CEOs making $20 million a year.
Mm-hmm.
The tellers get decent teller pay and get good benefits, which is quite rare in the banking industry. Being a bank teller is one of the last good, solid 9-to-5 jobs that you don't need a college degree for. And so it's great to be able to give those people great benefits. And so they look after their employees because their employees are stakeholders, just like the people with the bank accounts and the borrowers. And everyone just comes together to try and make it work as well as they can for the community. There's no external group of shareholders who are demanding lots of profits.
Credit union's like a little organic farm upstate is what I'm getting, like a co-op.
Yeah, and often you'll find that their online banking doesn't have quite as many bells and whistles as, you know, some big bank would.
Right, and unlike the upstate farm, like you're not going to be volunteering to like work as a teller like Saturday a week.
If they ask you to do that, don't go to that credit union. That's not a good credit union.
So let's talk about credit cards then, where we were headed before. I have a credit card for which I pay an annual fee. Am I already doing it wrong?
Maybe, maybe not. I mean, I would say if you have a credit card for which you pay an annual fee, you should only have one.
Mm-hmm.
If you have many credit cards for which you're having an annual fee, that's bad. Anything more than one is bad. If you have one and you put the overwhelming majority of your purchases onto that one card and you get some kind of loyalty benefit or you get to waltz into certain airline lounges or whatever it is, you get to stay free hotel nights or whatever, you know, from the fact that you just spend so much money on that one card and the benefits are worth more to you than the fee is, then that's a simple cost benefit. I would generally say that if you get $1,000 of benefit and the fee is $200, then yeah, that makes sense. But if you're paying $500 for some swanky card and you never use any of the benefits, yeah, you'd probably be better off with the $500.
What about the all-important credit score? Should people spend on credit cards just so they have that score there?
I'm a little bit heterodox on this. Like, most personal finance has very simple true and false answers. I am a little bit off the reservation when it comes to credit scores. I think that people massively overemphasize the importance of credit scores, and they really shouldn't worry about credit scores nearly as much as they do. Your credit score does make a little bit of difference at the margin when you're doing something like applying for a mortgage or a car loan, but people have this idea that it defines the quality of their existence in the way that it really doesn't. What you should do is have a healthy financial lifestyle where you spend less than you earn and you stay on top of your debts and you don't default on people that you borrow from. And if you do that kind of thing, then naturally a healthy credit score will follow. But the analogy I like to make is that it's a little bit like losing weight, that you want to be healthy. And if you're getting healthier and fitter, that one of the signs of that is that you're losing weight. But what you don't want to do is just completely monomaniacally concentrate on your weight and just try and lose weight without actually worrying about your health. Your weight should be a symptom of being healthy rather than the end goal in itself. And I think too many people look at the credit score as something which they should try and game and improve rather than just being a sort of thing which drops out of being financially healthy.
And these are for-profit companies, these credit bureaus, right? Like Experian, there was news today that they were fined for, I don't know if it was intentionally, but giving information that was confusing to customers.
One thing I will say is that you should never, ever pay for your credit score. If anyone ever asks you to sign up for a service which involves paying some kind of a subscription fee or even a one-off fee for your credit score, don't do it. There's a million ways to get your credit score for free. Credit Karma is one app which will do it for you for free. Many credit cards will let you check your credit score for free. So don't pay for it. Yeah, these are for-profit companies. They are not necessarily on the side of the angels. Often they have information wrong about you. It's important to know when they have information wrong about you, and then trying to fix that information is non-trivial, although it's getting a little bit easier these days. So you should be on top of it. It should be something you're aware of, but it shouldn't be something which you really worry about too much.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Let's talk about debt. We're a nation of debtors. It's a huge problem. It's a huge problem specifically for young people. Now, the Wall Street Journal did a story a couple years ago in which they determined that 2/3 of millennials have at least one source of long-term debt and outstanding, whether it's student loans or it's mortgages or car payments, and more than half of millennials carry a balance on their credit cards. So this is an issue. How the hell are we supposed to pay off our debt?
Long-term debt is actually the good debt. Long-term debt is a sign that you've invested in yourself in some way. If you have student loans, that's generally an indication that you might have a degree, and degrees are great ways of boosting your lifetime earnings. If you have a mortgage, that's an indication that you're like on that property ladder and you have that sort of vague hope of being a middle-class, you know, person. The short-term revolving debt, the credit card debt, is the really dangerous stuff. Also, long-term debt is generally low interest rate. Mortgage rates are, what, 3, 4, 5%. Student loans are nearly always in the single digits. It's the credit cards where you start getting into 20, 30% and really painful stuff. And it's not being used to finance investment in yourself or in a building. It's just being used to finance consumption. It's that bottle of wine. It's the holiday. It's the stuff which was fun but is not really going to improve your financial position in any way. So the good news is that even though millennials have long-term debt, that's the debt, that's the kind of the good debt, and they have less credit card debt than many, virtually all previous generations since the baby boomers. So we're kind of learning our lessons. Maybe it's for the wrong reason, which is just that we have so much student loans that we just don't have any ability to borrow more on credit cards. But it looks like it's more than that. I think this generation has lived through the financial crisis. They saw the damage the debt has done. And behaviorally, they're just much less likely to rack up huge credit card obligations than my generation was.
So should you borrow money in order to pay off your credit card?
Yes.
Why?
It's simple mathematics that if your credit card has a 20% interest rate and you can borrow money at 8%, then you should totally borrow money at 8% to pay off a 20% credit card balance. You just want the lowest overall balance you can have. That's why you should pay off your highest interest rate credit cards first. The only violation of this rule, the only exception to this rule, is be very wary about borrowing money against your house. So don't take out home equity loans. Don't take out a second mortgage, like something like that, to pay down your credit cards, because that's secured debt. And if you default on your credit cards, then, you know, that's a debt default. If you default on your mortgage, then someone can seize your house and literally throw you out on the street. So long as you're not borrowing secured, if you can find someone who will lend you unsecured money from Lending Club or SoFi or somewhere like that to just consolidate all of your credit card debt, put it in one place and bring down the interest rate and put it on a payment plan that you can afford and you can pay down, that's a great idea.
For the average person who is scared about going someplace like Lending Club and being like, all right, I have this credit card debt, I'm going to take out a loan at a lower interest rate, and starts to feel like, oh my God, what am I doing? I'm taking on more debt. Are there like financial advisors that are actually affordable or free that people can avail themselves of so that, you know, after they finish listening to this podcast and they don't have a direct line to you except for maybe on Twitter, they say something
clever?
At Felix
Salmon on Twitter, I will answer your questions. Financial advisors, what you need to do is think about it this way. People like me who understand the basic common sense of personal finance are not that hard to find. But we don't make a living out of giving out this advice. And if we did, it would be weird because where would our income come from? If you come up to me with a simple question like, should I take my credit cards and refinance it on Lending Club? I can give you a simple answer, and the answer will probably be yes, depending on the interest rates. But how am I going to make money? And if you're looking for a financial advisor, most of them only start really getting interested in talking to you when you start having a lot of assets. If you have $100,000 that you want to invest in the stock market, then they can say, well, I'll charge you 1% of your assets, and then I will help you invest it in the right place or something. And then they can make $1,000 a year, and then they might start being interested, even though that's relatively low. But in general, people who want money for advice, often there's a scam going on. Often they have an ulterior motive. A lot of these debt consolidation places on the internet and stuff like that are just not to be trusted. Trust your common sense before you trust people who might be scamming you.
Let's say I'm like someone that's just barely keeping my head above water, and like maybe I'm getting by, but I don't have extra money to pay off my debts. Could I still get a loan? Would they approve me for a loan to help pay for that?
So the whole point about consolidating credit card debt is that your debt isn't going up, right? If you have a credit card with $1,000 and one with $5,000 and one with $3,000, and that's $9,000 in total, then you have $9,000 of high interest debt. And if you get a $9,000 loan from wherever, you use that to pay off all of your credit cards and bring them down to zero and then just have one $9,000 loan. So the amount that you are in debt has not gone up. It just stays constant at $9,000. But now, instead of having 20% interest rates on your credit cards, you're now paying like 7% on that loan, and that's more manageable, and you can pay it down to zero over time. The one big thing which you have to remember, and which is the big problem, which is the catch here, is that once you've done that, you have to stop using your credit cards as a way of borrowing money. And that is actually a really good opportunity at that point to cut up your credit cards and say, look, behaviorally speaking, I'm not the kind of person who realistically pays off 100% of my credit card at the end of every month. If you're not that person, don't have a credit card. If you don't pay off your credit card at the end of every month in full, you are better off with just using debit cards.
So easy to say that, and we don't have to get too deep into this, but like, people want things, right? Like, they want to go out with their friends. They want to go out on vacation. They want to have a certain lifestyle, even if it's not a super extravagant lifestyle, like they want to buy groceries. So saying like, if you are not the kind of person who pays off their credit card every month and don't have a credit card is sort of not taking into account sort of the psychology of wanting to like be a person in the world and what credit cards were made to do, right? Which is to tempt you to spend money that you don't have.
Absolutely. I mean, I wouldn't for a minute say that this was easy, but if you don't have that invisible temptation, the problem with credit cards is, as I say, that they conflate the borrowing and the spending. That when you're making the purchase, you don't realize that you're borrowing the money. If you have a debit card and then you're forced to like go to the bank to borrow money if you want to take a vacation, you can do that. You can go to the bank and borrow money and say, I want to go on a vacation. I don't have the cash right now, so can I borrow $1,000 so I can go on vacation? And that's totally legit. There's no problem with that. But that's a conscious decision to borrow the money at a certain interest rate. If you're just putting it on a credit card, then it's an unconscious decision, and you're not really aware that you're borrowing the money when you're making the expenditure. So if you're the kind of person who doesn't pay off your entire balance at the end of every month, you're better off using debit cards to make your expenditures, to do the payments, and then finding some other debt, you know, whether it's from the bank or like some kind of online product where you can just get a loan and then pay that loan back. Or there's the old-fashioned way, which is really kind of, it's becoming more popular these days, which is this thing called saving up for a big purchase. You want to go on vacation. You say, I'm going on vacation this summer. Like right now is April. I'm going on vacation in August. I have this many months. The vacation is going to cost me that much. I'm going to create a little bank account where I throw $30 a week. And then by the time I get there, I'll be able to afford it, whatever it is. Places like Simple, which I talked about earlier, have the goals functionality. Many other bank accounts offer something similar. Little baby custom savings account where you can save up for something and then spend it, which is a lot cheaper than paying for it first and then paying a bunch of interest later.
So I've never heard that before, and I've done a lot of studying about personal finance. Like, I've never heard somebody recommend actually going to a bank or some kind of other lender besides a credit card in order to take out a loan. You know, it seems like the opposite of using a credit card is always save up, right? But like, there is this option to take out a loan, which is essentially what you're doing when you charge something on your credit card, and take out money when you need it.
Banks don't encourage it. The reason why people don't do this is because banks deliberately make it difficult to take out loans, because the loans are relatively low interest rates compared to the credit cards. And so they make less money right on the loans than they would on the credit card. So they encourage people to use the credit card as the first opportunity to borrow money. But there's absolutely, especially now with this like very competitive online lending space, there's a lot of places you can go online to borrow money, especially if you have a college degree. You can go to somewhere like Upstart or SoFi, and they will lend you money for virtually any reason. You don't need to say, I'm using it to consolidate credit card debt. You can just say, you can say, I'm using it because I want to go to the Bahamas. And it works out much cheaper that way.
And we'll link to Felix's favorite lenders in the show notes so that you don't have to rewind to find all of these different awesome lenders that I've never heard of.
And what about student loans? Because that's, I think the majority of us, at least our younger generation, are kind of saddled with these huge loans that we feel like we're going to be paying off until we retire or after we retire. Should that be a big priority for people? Or because it's kind of like the long-term debt you talked about, should people not worry too much about the long-term weight of that?
I mean, if there are people who don't worry about student loans out there, I haven't met them. Like, student loans are just something which people worry about, and quite rightly, because they're huge. You have tens of thousands of dollars in student loans.
Or hundreds.
Or sometimes even over 100. If you have over $100,000 in student loans, that's crazy. But there are lots of people who do. And, you know, it's going to take you a really long time to pay it back. Unless you're, you know, if you take out that kind of debt to go to law school or medical school, then it's a slightly different thing. But if you have that from getting a MFA, then you're in trouble.
Guilty. Not anymore. I paid it off, but that's another conversation.
But student loans are tough and intractable. And in a weird way, the good news about student loans is that they just sit there and you pay them back at a certain rate. There's not a lot of ledger domain going on around them. You don't have a huge amount of people like ripping you off in the student loan space. There aren't people making lots of money by abusing, you know, former students who don't understand what they're getting themselves in for. Most student loans by value are still federal loans. The federal government is not a loan shark. You know, they will make a decent amount of money off you, to be sure, but they're not completely evil. So if you're paying off your federal loans at whatever rate the federal government is telling you that you should, and you're taking advantage of the PAYE and all of those other, you know, income-based plans that you have access to, you're basically doing it right. Student loans aren't insane interest rates. You're doing what you can. If you have lower income, you can normally qualify to pay back less. And it's unpleasant to have to pay that every month when you're on a relatively low income anyway and you're just out of college and you're like, I can't afford this. It's the reality and it sucks. But there's not a huge amount of optional value there. The one thing which is beginning to happen is that you have these online lenders offering to refinance student loans. And so that's where SoFi got so big, and there's a bunch of others like Earnest. You can save a bit of money that way. If you are relatively convinced that you're never going to run into money troubles ever again or see your income evaporate, then refinancing using these lenders, if they will take you, and a lot of time they won't. Someone like SoFi will reject more people than they accept. But if they will take you and you're earning lots of money, then you can save a bit of money on your student loans. Just remember that you lose all of those wonderful federal plans that I was talking about, the income-based plans, the protections that you get if you lose your job, the way you can forgive a certain amount of debt if you wind up in public service, that kind of stuff all goes out the window. You're committed to paying back the full amount. And what's more, because it still counts as a student loan, it's still got that really nasty characteristic of not being dischargeable in bankruptcy. Even if you declare bankruptcy, that loan is still going to be hanging around your neck.
And you probably shouldn't use credit cards to pay your student loans, right? I'm sure there's people listening that have done that.
So realistically, we're all talking about like paying off all of your debts in full on time, pay off your credit cards, pay off your car loans, pay off your mortgage, pay off your student loans. This is the real world, and sometimes you've got to prioritize. And one of the things which you see when you look at the various different debts that people have is that student loans are kind of the first thing that people default on. And that makes sense, because what harm is realistically done if you miss a month's payment on your student loan? It will affect your credit score, but as we've said, you know, any default is going to affect your credit score. If you're going to default anyway, then student loans are not a stupid place to make that first default, especially if you can catch up in the next couple of months. Using your credit card to pay the student loan is a bad idea because it's much higher interest rate and you don't get that much value out of it.
Let's talk for a second about the difference between debt with millennials and Gen Xers. How is the type of debt that they have different? How do they view debt differently? Like, what is the difference? Like, because you're Gen X?
I'm Gen X.
I'm Gen X. Andy, are you a millennial?
I guess I'd be a millennial.
Okay, yeah. So we're all represented here.
So statistically speaking, my generation, Gen X, was really quite profligate on the old credit cards. Also, we had less student debt. Millennials are the other way around, more student debt, less credit card debt. And frankly, that's better, you know? And if you've lived through the financial crisis and that was this kind of searing formative experience of your youth, and you saw how bad things get when people borrow too much, that kind of creates this behavioral response, which you also saw in, I guess they're called the greatest generation, the people who lived through the Depression, you know, you would find would never borrow money because they saw how painful it was to be in that situation. And obviously the financial crisis wasn't as bad as the Depression, but it was bad. And there's going to be generational effects of that for decades to come, and probably good ones. My generation and our parents' generation borrowed too much, and mostly for bad reasons. And if you borrow less, that's good.
How do you feel about renting versus buying a house and mortgages and all of that?
Do what's cheaper. It's very simple. I think people in my generation got very greedy and wound up spending a lot of money on houses they couldn't really afford and persuaded themselves that they were investing rather than just spending and got into a lot of trouble as a result. If your choice is between renting and buying, and if renting is cheaper than buying, if it costs you less money per month, to a first approximation, you should probably rent. If you can get the same amount of house for a lower monthly payment by buying it, then buying it makes a lot of sense. So do what's cheaper. The one thing which people find difficult to understand, but it's totally true, they have this idea that if you're renting, you're throwing your money away. And if you're buying, you're like investing in your future. It really doesn't work like that financially. And I can go into the boring financial reasons why. But if you have a mortgage, then you're throwing your money at the bank just like you would otherwise be throwing your money at
but
the landlord.
But equity, everybody says equity. It's this huge thing. I've been renting an apartment in New York City for 9,000 years and I have nothing to show for it.
It's true. And if you had a huge chunk of money at the beginning of that process, which you could have spent on a down payment, then you would now have equity. But just think, if you had a huge chunk of money at the beginning of that process, you could have put it in the stock market. And over the past 9,000 years, or however long you've been in New York, the stock market has probably tripled. So you would have equity, but you probably wouldn't have as much equity as you'd have in stocks if you'd just taken that money and put it into stocks. So building equity is good, and there is a case to be made that buying a house is a really effective forced savings vehicle. It's a way, because people don't default on their mortgages, they're really, really careful to make sure they make that mortgage payment every month. It's a way of forcing them to effectively save a certain amount of money every month, month in, month out, and then over the decades, that builds up into equity. So I believe in that, and I think that that's true, but if it costs much more than it would cost to rent, then you're still better off renting.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Do we want to talk about saving money? Because for a lot of people, it's a choice between putting money into their bank account or paying down their debts. And there's a balance people need to find.
Right. Like when you have a ton of debt, it's really hard to say like you should be saving money, pay yourself first, all these sort of maxims that you hear about personal finance. Like when you're just trying to like pay for your rent and all of your expenses and then also pay down whatever debt that you have, it's really hard to think about saving.
Correct. And in a way, you should think about paying down debt as saving. You're much better off with $4,000 of credit card debt than you are with $5,000 of credit card debt and $1,000 in a savings account. So especially if you have that extra $1,000 of like free credit available on your credit card if you need it. So it's you almost have the exact same amount of liquidity available to you, but you just have less debt. So there's really no reason to have a savings account with money in it, whether it's a CD or just a normal savings account, and also have credit card debt or any kind of debt that you can pay down, which isn't super long-term debt like student loans or a mortgage. If you have any debt which isn't student loans or a mortgage, the simple answer is no, you shouldn't be saving. You should be taking whatever spare money you can cobble together and just throw that towards paying down your debt, because you're getting an incredible return on that money. If you have a savings account, you might get, what, 1% or 2% on that? If you're paying down your credit card, you're paying yourself 25% on that. It's much smarter to do that. Just think of paying down your debt as a really effective form of savings. So anyone with debt, just concentrate on that first. Don't even think about savings.
Let's say I have paid off my debt.
Well done.
Thank you. I'm in a position to save. Where am I putting my extra shekels?
Do you have a bank account? If you have a bank, you probably have a bank which offers savings accounts.
You told me not to have a bank account.
So that's often a good point in your sort of financial evolution to open a bank account. There are debit cards as well which have savings vehicles attached. But yeah, a simple savings account is generally a good place to start. Don't try and be too clever. Don't try and open up some online account which will invest your money in the stock market and, you know, all of that kind of thing. Just have a simple savings account which isn't connected to your debit card, which is kind of out of sight, out of mind, and you can sort of say, I'm just going to try and save a little bit. One really effective way of doing it is setting up a direct debit. So maybe your employer will pay most of your money into your checking account and then a little bit into your savings account, and you just never see it. Try not to look at your balances too often and just ignore it and just let it build up automatically without even seeing it. And don't worry about the interest that you're getting. Don't worry about how it's invested. Just keep it in cash. The best way to wind up with more money is to just save more money. The 18th best way is to try and, like, invest it cleverly so that it grows.
Really? Like, I mean, I feel that way, but I feel like it's this sort of inherited depression mentality or something where I want to make sure that all my money is accessible to me at all times. So I've always felt like, oh, I should be investing more. I shouldn't have this money just sitting in a savings account. But so you're saying that's not true?
Well, I mean, that's two different things.
Okay.
If you're investing it, it's not available to
right.
you. Right. If it's just sitting in the savings account, it is available
right,
to you.
Right, that's what
I'm saying. And I'm saying you're right. It should be available to you. Don't invest it. Keep it in a savings account. Don't worry about the interest that you're getting on it. Don't worry about stocks and bonds and all of that and mutual funds. Just keep it in the bank. And so long as the amount of money that you have in that account is less than 6 months' expenditures, don't even think about anything more sophisticated.
And what if we do have a little extra? At what point do we start investing and how do we get started doing that?
A little extra, again, if you have a little extra, put it in a savings account. Mm. If you, and then look at how much you spend on every month or every year. This is a worthwhile exercise for everyone. Very few people do it, but it's totally worth doing. It's to just get a gut feel for how much money you spend between like rent and groceries and everything. Add it up and work out what's 6 months of that. And it's going to be quite a scarily large figure. And you probably don't have that in your savings account. But if you do, if you are so on top of your finances that you have half a year's worth of expenditures just sitting there in your savings account doing nothing, then and only then can you start thinking about, okay, now I should start thinking about putting the extra stuff into some kind of investment vehicle. I would recommend target date fund of some description or certainly an index fund. Don't pay lots of money. Don't try and be clever. Don't try and pick stocks. Go to a robo-advisor like Betterment or Wealthfront or Vanguard. And just say, you know, in general, the gold standard is always Vanguard. Vanguard is a little bit like those credit unions we talked about. It's not a for-profit company. It's kind of owned by the people who use it. They're very low fee, and you can just buy an index fund through them and, again, set it and forget it. But for most of us, as I say, they probably haven't even got to that point. It's a very advanced thing. The only place where you should be investing in stocks, if you don't have that kind of money in your savings account, is if you have an employer and they have a 401k, they'll help match your savings, and there's tax advantages to putting $5,500 a year or whatever it is into your 401k. So do that. But any post-tax money you have lying around is less likely to find its way into the stock market.
A question about 401ks. You should, if you can, always put as much money as you can up to the point that your company matches it, right?
Yes.
Because that's just
and
free
if
money.
And possible, even more. I think the total maximum that you can put into any 401k each year is about $14,500.
Right.
So if you have $14,500 right. of disposable income, which you can just put into your 401k, totally do that because there are great tax advantages to
but
doing that.
But if my employer is matching up to 6%, the minimum I should put in, if I can, is 6%,
yes.
right?
If your employer is dangling free money in front of you, then take that free money.
And when I'm setting up my 401k, you're saying, put money in a retirement account and that's it, and put it in an index fund, right? Like,
yes.
Don't get aggressive. You get this huge buffet of options when you open a 401k, and you can choose all these different funds.
Okay, there are two choices. Either just put it in an index fund. If you're relatively young, then it's okay to be entirely invested in the stock market. Put it in the S&P 500. Set it in, just pick the lowest fee index fund you can find and choose that. The alternative, which is equally good and possibly even better, is this thing called a target date fund. So you'll say, I expect to retire in 2055. And so you put it into a 2055 target date fund, and then it will automatically change your ratio of stocks and bonds that you have over the decade, so that when you retire, you're a bit less risky in terms of your asset allocation.
Are there any good apps we should be using? Like, there's Mint. There are all these different kind of cute apps that are trying to get me to save money, or they're trying to help me manage my money or make a budget. Are there any of these any good?
I was going to ask you that question. You're kind of the expert on that, because
I have opinions about it, but I'm wondering what you think.
I'm always a little bit suspicious about these apps. I feel that they encourage us to spend too much time thinking about and being aware of things which we shouldn't be thinking about and being aware of. In general, it's a good idea to know how much money you have in the bank, and that's about it. That's the only real number you should care about. And most banks, have an app where you can just force press the button and it'll tell you how much money you have in the bank, and that's the only number you need. Beyond that, the whole palaver of using apps to divvy things up and be on top of everything. Some people like to do it, and I'm not saying it's a bad thing to do, but it's a huge amount of time and effort, and I've never entirely been convinced that there's a worthwhile payoff at the end of it.
Well, for some people, there's like an automation aspect, right? So they spend a lot of time all at once, and then it just works afterwards.
Do you know those people? I just haven't met one of those people, but maybe they exist.
I've used Mint. I think Mint is good. I don't need it, but I have heard from other people that they like it, or they like something that's going to be pulling in all their financial information and, making budgets for them. My fear with those things is that they're selling my information to companies and profiling me, and it's all part of sort of like the great information bank.
A Mint is owned by Intuit, which is evil. Just remember that.
Intuit's evil?
Oh, yeah.
Intuit of Quicken Loans?
And TurboTax, I think.
And TurboTax, who spend hundreds of millions of dollars lobbying the federal government to make it as hard as possible to file taxes. Because if it's really hard to file your taxes, then you pay money for TurboTax. And if it was easy to file your taxes, then you wouldn't. They're very invested in a highly complex tax code.
I see, like, a good way for you not to make money, but a nice, like, public service that you could do would be to, give people, your budgeting system, and so they wouldn't have to tangle with these companies.
That would be great if I was someone who had a budgeting system. But, like, I'm relatively good when it comes to money, but I'm far from perfect, and that's the one place where I fall short, is I really haven't found a budgeting system. And I feel like budgeting systems are a little bit like diets, that different ones work for different people. A friend of mine weirdly swears by the Dave Ramsey system, which is literally you take envelopes and put dollar bills in them, and then you spend money out of a specific envelope for a specific purpose. So you have like the groceries envelope and the movies envelope and the rent envelope, and you use each one for each thing. And then when you run out of money in each envelope, there's no money left to spend on that thing for the rest of the month. That sounds far too complicated for me, but it's effective if you're on a very strict budget. There are other budgeting systems which other people use, and I guess the amount of sort of ex-ante constraint that you want to place yourself under and the amount of pain that you wind up in if you go over your budget differs so much from person to person that I don't think there's much in the way of one-size-fits-all solutions here.
I want to tell you guys about a saving system that I heard about that I think can help some people, which is a friend of a friend knew a drug dealer. She died, and when they went into her apartment, they found $5 bills stashed everywhere, like all over the apartment. So my friends came up with this idea that every time you get a $5 bill, put it away. What do you think about that? The drug dealer-inspired $5 bill savings plan. So every time you get a five, you don't spend it. I mean, I guess this is predicated on you actually spending cash, and then you put it away.
I feel like back in your friend of a friend of a friend's day, $5 bills were slightly more common than they are now.
Right.
Now I just Venmo everything.
It's right. Just, you know. It's true. I guess it doesn't really work unless you're working in cash.
Yeah, but the idea is that you build a habit, I think. So it's just whenever you get a five, you don't even think about it and you put it away.
Yeah.
In between your carpet things. Or
and
your,
then
your...
and if you find yourself in an emergency, you can say, it's okay, I can pay for this new tire on my car
with my
$5 bills.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, it sounds good, right? I don't know. I think you should look into it. That might be just the budgeting plan for you.
I'm sold. I'm going to have a $5 bill shoebox.
Perfect.
To get back to like the thesis of this podcast for a second, what do you think are the most common stupid money habits people have? That they think maybe they're making the right decision, but actually it's kind of dumb.
So the most common stupid thing that people do, and over half of Americans do this, is they allow their bank to persuade them to sign up for overdraft protection. Do not do that. Ever since Dodd-Frank passed, what, 8 years ago now, 7 years ago, banks have not been allowed to charge you overdraft fees unless you write them a letter basically saying, yes, I want overdraft protection. You should totally be able to charge me overdraft fees. Don't write that letter. Don't sign that piece of paper. Don't click that button on the website. Do not use overdraft protection. It is a scam. It is a massive source of profits for the banks, and it gives you no real value.
And now we've reached that part of our show where we talk about an upgrade we've made in our own life this week. Melissa, have you done anything?
Yes. I have improved my life by finally caving and getting a subscription to the New York Times crossword puzzle. I only get the Weekender as far as the paper goes. I do get the paper on the weekend, and I'm a crossword puzzle addict, but I only end up doing the Saturday and Sunday crossword puzzles because those are the only puzzles that I get, and I try to make them stretch out over the course of the week. And then I realized that I was denying myself this subscription to the online crossword puzzle archive of the New York Times somehow because I felt like, I don't know, that it was pure to do the crossword on paper and
right.
I should buy the paper if I'm going to do it. And, you know, I have to do it in pen because
crosswords are so much better on your phone. It's the best way to do them.
Really?
I disagree. Really? Do you do them on your phone?
You know what I've just become addicted to is this app called TypeShift. Do you know Zach Gage, who did Very Bad Chess? He has a new app out called TypeShift, which is awesome. And it's not really a crossword puzzle, but you can get clues like crosswords, and you have to do dials to make the word. It sounds more complicated than it is. It's really intuitive and kind of addictive, and that's an awesome app recommendation if you want one.
Okay, I will check that out.
I also approve of all crossword puzzle subscriptions because the world needs more crossword puzzles.
I'm like a total cliche from a personal ad about the the New York Times crossword puzzle. Like, I'm proud of myself for being able to do the puzzle in pen. And so when you do it online, like, there's no risk if you...
So what's the subscription that you bought?
Since I'm already a subscriber to the paper, it's only, like, $7 for the whole year. You get access to the entire New York Times archive.
On paper?
No, on the app. So,
but you don't like it on the app?
I don't prefer it, but... It will do because I need puzzles on days that aren't the weekend. And the fact that now I can, you know, only do the hard ones like every single day.
So you can do a Sunday puzzle every day of the week for as long as you live because there are that many of them.
But I'm not going to go back too far because like when Eugene Maleska was the editor, like it was all like Cold War stuff. Like I only can actually do it now because I'm living now and I can't do the old ones because the references are too difficult. I mean, the Cold War wouldn't be a difficult reference, but there are other things from, you know, the 80s and before that are tougher. And it's changed with the new editor. Anyway, if anybody wants to talk about crossword puzzles, you can tweet me at Melissa Kirsch.
And as a good Englishman, I will be the guy to say no. Cryptic crosswords are where it's at, and you should do the Guardian crossword instead because it's amazing.
What's a cryptic crossword?
Oh, if you've never done a cryptic crossword, it's like a whole other level of crosswords, which is amazing.
It might be too much.
It might be too much puzzling. Like I do have to like shower and go to work.
Cryptic crosswords. Once you get into them, oh my god!
Do you do them regularly?
I don't do them. I used to when I was in England, and then I moved here, and I kind of stopped. But when I go back or when I come across one, getting those clues, the feeling is amazing.
We know that the English are much smarter than we are, so it's probably going to be too difficult. And, you know, part of doing the crossword is, like, making myself feel good about myself. So, anyway, that's my upgrade of the week. My life has gotten so much better now that all of my downtime is spent doing crossword puzzles.
That sounds pretty good to me. Felix, have you done anything this week to improve your life?
You know what I did this week to improve my life, Andy? Mm. Is I went ahead and spent $26 on a bottle of Frank Cornelison's Contadino, which is a lovely, earthy, weird, organic red wine from Sicily. And I started drinking it at 12:30 on Friday in a podcast, and I'm still drinking it on this podcast. And I can highly recommend, I have this theory that spending just a little bit more money than you would normally spend on a bottle of wine is the most reliable and effective way of turning money into happiness that anyone has ever invented. The act of going out, finding that bottle, opening that bottle, opening it and enjoying it with friends and colleagues and appreciating it because you made the effort of spending the money, it always causes pleasure, and this is why you should go ahead and treat yourself to a good bottle of wine this weekend.
I think that's good advice. Although I will say personally, the nice boxed wine is like a guilty pleasure of mine. I don't know what brand it is, but...
Bandito, perhaps?
Maybe it's Bandito.
I've seen that one.
But on the rare occurrence that I feel like wine, I go for the box, and I'm pretty happy about it.
They do last a long time.
That is a plus. Maybe you'll try and buy yourself a bottle of Sicilian red or whatever that is.
Maybe I'll do a little upgrade, you could say.
Oh, Andy.
Man, that guy's a pro.
Yeah, that's right. And my own actual upgrade this week, I was thinking about what has actually improved my life recently. And I usually say something stupid, like I bought new sweatpants or I'm using big ice cube trays or whatever. But what actually did make a difference was when we unionized with the Writers Guild. Long story short, we eventually got a contract. And now we have like an actual way to represent ourselves to management and our corporate overlords. So we actually have a way to represent our wants and needs. And this is something that has actually improved our lives because now we have the benefits we need. So if anyone works at a place where you have the opportunity to unionize, I would recommend it.
And I just came from Slate, which is unionizing as
we
speak.
That's true.
Thanks for coming, Felix.
It was fun and delicious, thanks to my Frank Cornelison Contadino.
Great. Well, maybe we'll have you back to talk about finances someday soon.
I will talk about anything. I don't just talk about finance, and I always bring a good bottle of wine.
All right, then we'll definitely have you back.
I'm going to manage my money so I can afford the nicer wine, I think.
And that's our show. You can find me on Twitter at Melissa Kirsch. You can find Andy at Andy Oren. And you can find Felix Salmon at Felix Salmon. That's salmon like the fish.
The Upgrade is produced by Levi Sharp. Our executive director of audio is Mandana Mofidi. Jamie Colazzo mixed the episode.
Do you have a suggestion for future episodes of The Upgrade? Shoot us an email at upgrade@lifehacker.com. Tweet us at lifehacker with the hashtag TheUpgrade. Or go old school and leave us a voice message at 347-687-8109. And if you love The Upgrade, please go to iTunes and leave us a review.
Follow Lifehacker on Twitter at Lifehacker and on Facebook at facebook.com/lifehacker. And you can find show notes for this and every episode of The Upgrade at lifehacker.com/the show.